This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. The Clint Eastwood thriller Mystic River opened this week. It stars Sean Penn as a man whose daughter has been murdered, and Lawrence Fishburne and Kevin Bacon as detectives assigned to the case.
We've been interviewing witnesses, canvassing people that might have been in the bar. We've run into more than a few of them who were questioned before us by one or more of the Savage brothers.
So the Savages are not policemen, Jim?
Yeah, some people don't talk to policemen, Sean.
With all due respect, Mr. Markham, and just so we're clear, this is our case.
How long?
How long what?
How long before you catch my daughter's killer, I need to know.
Are you bargaining with us?
Bargaining?
You giving us a deadline? We'll speak for Katie, Mr. Markham, if that's okay with you.
You just find my daughter's killer, Sergeant. I'm not standing in your way.
Dennis Lehane wrote the novel on which the film is based. He's best known for his series of Private Eye novels featuring the team of Patrick Kenzie and Angie Gennaro. But Mystic River isn't part of that series and isn't a Private Eye novel. It begins in 1975, when three boys are fighting in the street and a couple of cops drive by to break it up. Two of the boys flee. The third is picked up by the cops, who actually turn out to be child molesters posing as cops. The boy is released after several days and returns home traumatized. The story picks up 25 years later and follows the lives of the three childhood friends. Terry spoke with Lehane in 2001 after Mystic River came out. She asked him if the abduction in the novel relates to anything that happened to him as a child.
No, I'm not a big believer in autobiographical fiction, if you will. I believe in the place and the flavor of the world you grew up in, but I don't believe in the particulars. I don't believe in, oh, remember when, you know, Johnny Sullivan did this and he had this certain way of smiling. Let's take that and put it in a book. I don't do that. But I do try and capture sort of, again, the texture and the flavor of the world I grew up in. This incident happened actually to myself and a friend of mine who were, not quite arrested, but we were taken off the street and we were getting in a fight and we were kids. And in the sort of heat of the moment, neither of us thought to ask for a badge. They turned out the gentlemen were cops, but that was something that always stuck in my head, I think, because my mother looked so terrified.
She suspected that maybe they weren't cops?
No, she just didn't. She thought the whole incident seemed weird at the time. It turned out they were police officers, everything, but I'll never forget the fear when, you know, she said, you saw their badge, right?
No, it's this abduction that sets everything in motion in your new novel.
Yep.
There's sexual abuse in an earlier book, Gone Baby Gone, where a child's abducted. You worked briefly, I think, counseling children who have been abused. What kind of work did you do?
I was a therapeutic counselor in a treatment facility. We would take kids from review files in juvenile hall, and we would pick kids who we thought were sort of in the gray area between when a victim turns into a victimizer, and we would try and get them before they turned into victimizers and help them. And that was what we did, and that was the place I worked.
What are some of the things you learned during that experience that you used in your writing?
Well, I think I remember a woman I was dating at the time said, that she had never seen me angry until I took this job. You know, that I was a pretty, even keel type of guy. So I discovered a capacity for anger at just the waste that I'd see. I also discovered a very sort of dirty secret of social work, which was, 9 out of 10 times it's the parent. You can trace it back to the parent. A bad seed is a very rare thing. And it's not society and it's not Marilyn Manson and it's not, it's kids who were abused or kids who were neglected or kids who were badly parented who turn out to be, the kind of kids who shoot up schools or the kind of kids who become bullies or become murderers, become anything. And then it just depends upon the level of abuse. That can dictate a lot of things, because if the humanity is beaten out of you or sexually exploited out of you, then it's silly to expect that humanity will be recovered.
My guest is writer Dennis Lehane. Your new novel, Mystic River, is different from your other novels in that although there are crimes at its center, it's not about private detectives, and it's not part of your private detective series. Why was it time for you now to get out of that series and write a book that's independent of that?
Oh, I think it just, a lot of times it's just dictated by, you know, I wish we had a word for it, the inspiration, whatever you want to say. I was not inspired to write a book in the series. There was nothing there. The well was dry. And this book had been sort of gently rapping on the window for about 5 or 6 years. And then it began to really bang on the door about 2 years ago.
What was the message as it was banging?
You know, make a hole, make it wide, let us in. I always start with characters. I very rarely have a plot.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just the characters. And there was this one line, Brendan Harris loved Katie Marcus like crazy, loved her like movie love. And that line just kept spinning around in my head for years. I mean, 5 years probably. And then gradually I got the second line, which was it occurred to him as he was shaving that he was evil. And those two lines began to sort of become the the building blocks of the book.
And where do they actually turn up in the book?
Brendan Harris loved Katie Marcus like crazy is the very first line of the present day, first chapter in present day. That's the first line of chapter three, which is the first chapter in the 2000 section. And then it occurred to him while he was shaving that he was evil shows up in the last chapter.
So let me ask you to read that line that first came to you before the novel was written. And now it's that first line in the first chapter set in the present.
Sure. Brendan Harris loved Katie Marcus like crazy, loved her like movie love, with an orchestra booming through his blood and flooding his ears. He loved her waking up, going to bed, loved her all day and every second in between. Brendan Harris would love Katie Marcus fat and ugly. He'd love her with bad skin and no breasts and thick fuzz on her upper lip. He'd love her toothless. He'd love her bald. Katie, the trill of her name sliding through his brain was enough to make Brendan feel like his limbs were filled with nitrous oxide, like he could walk on water and bench press an 18-wheeler, toss it across the street when he was finished with it. Brendan Harris loved everyone now because he loved Katie and Katie loved him. Brendan loved traffic and smog and the sound of jackhammers. He loved his worthless old man who hadn't sent him a single birthday or Christmas card since he'd walked out on Brendan and his mother when Brendan was 6. He loved Monday mornings and standing in line at the RMV. He even loved his job, though he wouldn't be going in ever again.
So you used that sentence, that first sentence that came to your mind, to very good effect in this passage that you just read. Have you ever had a first sentence that came to your mind that you ended up not using by the time you actually got to writing the book?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that... so often you start with something and all it is a way to get you into a book. Like my next novel, which I've begun, I sort of already know that the first 10 pages I've written will never make the book, you know, but I had to put it in to sort of figure things out for myself. And the trick is you fall in love with some of the sentences and you just got to remember that Orwell line, you know, murder your darlings.
Right.
So...
What do you like about writing familiar characters when you are writing your Private Eye series?
Oh, it's wonderful because I think the same reason readers read these books is because gradually there becomes this almost tender familiarity with these people. And they're like old friends. And it's like saying, come on by, have a drink, you know? You say, come on into the book. Oh, we haven't seen him in a while. We haven't seen him in 400 pages since, you know, book number 4.
What are the limitations?
The reason I read and the reason I write is to discover things about characters. Plot is just a vehicle to do that. That's all plot is. It's just the actions by which a character is explicated. And I think gradually, the more you write about a character, the less... you don't know about them. And the more you read about a character, the less you don't know about them. And that's why I think that it's very rare you hear somebody speak about a series and say, yeah, but the 15th book is the best. Nobody ever says that. They always say the 5th book is the best or the 3rd book is the best. And I think that's because the characters have become overly familiar. And there is no sense of a journey. There are no epiphanies left to have about this person. So I think that's the point when you got to pull the plug.
Right.
I don't know if I've reached that point yet. I don't think I have, but I think I'm near it.
Dennis Lehane speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. We'll be back with more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with more of Terry's interview with Dennis Lehane, whose book Mystic River has just been made into a film by Clint Eastwood.
Did you have any relatives who were cops? Or,
no.
Or friends' fathers who were cops? Not to just dwell on cliche, but you grew up in an Irish neighborhood, and you know a lot of, particularly when you were growing up, probably a lot of Irish fathers were cops.
Oddly, no. no, not with my friends. I had one of my closest friends' uncle was a rather prominent cop, mm-hmm. but I had very little contact with him. My wife's family are all cops, but I didn't grow up around cops. I grew up around laborers, you know. Mm-hmm. My father worked for Sears and Roebuck. Most of my friends' fathers worked, you know, they were truck drivers, occasionally a postman. But no, we didn't grow up with that law enforcement vibe around us.
Did your opinion of or relationship with cops change from childhood to adulthood?
No, I think one of the greatest things about growing up in the inner city, if you see it correctly, was that we always knew the places never to go and say drink, for example, when you're 17 years old, underage drinking or smoke pot or whatever. The places to never commit crimes were small towns, because they always had the absolute toughest cops, because they had, our opinion at the time was, they had nothing better to do. Where in the inner city, we had police officers, and they were a lot of times putting their life, pretty much on the line. They were the ones dealing with gangs. They were the ones dealing with shootouts and homicides, etc. And so they tended to be very easy to deal with if you weren't in their face. And I think that was because they had a relative sense. So if they caught a couple of kids, underage kids drinking beer, they took your beer and they walked away. They didn't have anything to prove, I guess. So I think that gave me a respect for the city cop, for the guy who really has to go out and literally put his life on the line. Whereas small town police, to some extent, there's a bit of a Napoleon complex.
Dennis Lehane is my guest. There's a passage describing the neighborhood that the characters in your book grew up in that I'm going to ask you to read.
Sure. They all lived in East Buckingham, just west of downtown, a neighborhood of cramped corner stores, small playgrounds, and butcher shops where meat, still pink with blood, hung in the windows. The bars had Irish names and dodge darts by the curbs. Women wore handkerchiefs tied off at the backs of their skulls and carried mock leather snap purses for their cigarettes. Until a couple of years ago, older boys had been plucked from the streets as if by spaceships and sent to war. They came back hollow and sullen a year or so later, or they didn't come back at all. Days, the mothers searched the papers for coupons. Nights, the fathers went to the bars. You knew everyone. Nobody, except those older boys, ever left.
Is that an accurate description of the neighborhood you grew up in?
Yeah, I think that's pretty close. If you look back, my brother and I were always stunned to look back at pictures taken of us in 71, 73. And we look like we just, you know, we stepped off Main Street in Mayberry. I mean, we still had the buzz cuts, still, you know, the clothing was much more what you would think of in, say, 1963, Brooklyn, you know, just the look of everything. It was, you know, and then right down the street, you know, a couple of miles away, essentially, there's student sit-ins at Harvard. And Harvard Square looks like what you expect Harvard Square to look like circa 1971, 72. But none of that reached the neighborhoods.
What do you want to write about that neighborhood now?
In your 20s, if you're a writer, you spend a lot of your 20s discovering your strengths and your limitations. And what I discovered is while I could write about any place and do it adequately, the stuff that struck a chord that really reached people at a very gut level was the stuff I said in you know, inner city northeastern neighborhoods. Gradually you just go, you know, well, Fitzgerald never wrote about poor people really well, and Faulkner never wrote anything set outside of Mississippi that was any good, and so maybe that's my limitation. Maybe I shouldn't be trying on all these hats. Maybe I should go to my strength.
When you were a kid in the early 70s with the buzz cut, looking like you were in Mayberry RFD, what was your attitude about the college students protesting at Harvard? What did you think of them?
Oh, well, we had a very, I think, a very neighborhood attitude, which was, you know, this was also when busing was ripping the inner city apart. Mm-hmm. And there was this very, a siege mentality took over. Because the attitude of the establishment, certainly the establishment newspapers, was that it was a racial issue, where the people who were in the neighborhoods felt it was much more of a class warfare issue. It was about people who didn't live in the neighborhoods making decisions that affected the neighborhoods and then stepping back and letting the neighborhoods suffer. And I think certainly the sense of the, you know, when you would see the news and we'd see what was going on at Harvard or what was going on at, you know, Berkeley out in California or wherever, there was a sense of they're dilettantes, you know. They're the fortunate sons, where the people who are truly suffering for this aren't protesting because they're dead or they're dying because they couldn't afford to go to college, etc. So I think that was certainly, there was never a sense in my neighborhood that anybody thought Vietnam was a good idea. You know, never. I remember it was very clear. My father was, you know, if my brother got to that age, which he neared just as the war ended, you know, my father was ready to put him on a plane to Canada.
The characters in your new novel, Mystic River, don't go home at night and, you know, read novels.
No.
Were you a reader as a child? And
oh,
was
God.
That was that unusual in your neighborhood or in your family?
Yes, it was, in both. Well, my brothers were readers, my older brothers. They read a lot of, S.E. Hinton and, Robert Ludlum and things like that. There was reading, and my sister read a lot of classics. So there was reading in my family, certainly. And I just picked it up at a much more ferocious clip. I mean, I started reading when I was six. My mother took me to the library when I was six. And it's still the most pivotal event in my life, you know, it changed everything. And so did it seem a little odd to the neighborhood? Yeah, definitely. But the great thing is that everybody was pretty cool about it too. You know, it wasn't like everybody said, you know, oh, four. Well, I didn't wear glasses, but I wasn't ostracized for being a reader.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, that Lahane kid's a little odd, you know, in the same way that you'd say it about the kid who would every winter would stick his tongue to the pole, you know,
right.
It's a little, he's all right, but he's a little odd.
You know, you've written or are writing, I believe, a screenplay based on one of your Private Eye novels.
Yes.
So, do you have in mind the type of actor you'd like to play your Private Eyes, Patrick and Angie? And I'm wondering, do you want them to be ultra attractive or just to have a lot of screen presence?
Oh no, I'm much more of a character actor guy. I like people who just that whatever it is they got, nobody else has it. You know, I'm not talking star power, but say a guy like Will Patton, for mm-hmm. example. I don't even know if you know who that
yeah,
is,
I do.
But. Now there's a guy, you put him on the screen, and you know nobody else is going to give a performance like him. Nobody. Will Patton is Will Patton, you know? I tend towards character actors, which would make me a very bad Hollywood producer because I wouldn't get necessarily bankable stars. I think a perfect Patrick would be Ray Liotta. Although he might be a few years older than him, I think he'd be great. But I don't think Hollywood considers him an A-list star, if you know what I mean. The way they would, say, a Ben Affleck.
Right.
Or a Tom Cruise or something like that. I have my theories, but I also know they're rather impractical.
Is the movie being made?
It's certainly in development with Paramount. I have to turn in the second draft of the script next week.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
So we'll see what happens with it, but it's not an experience, I think. Having done it and worked extremely hard on it, I don't think I would ever do it again.
Why not?
Which is adapt one of my novels. It's just too, it's asking you to turn it into a Reader's Digest condensed book. You know, it's asking you to perform a, I wouldn't go so far as to say an abortion, but it's asking you to perform an operation in which large pieces are going to be removed. And the last person who should be asked to do that is the person who created that body in the first place.
So you worked so hard to get it right, and now you have to completely undo it.
Yeah, it's like books on tape, and they always ask me to approve the abridged copy.
Yeah.
And I always say on the phone, okay, it's approved. And they say, no, we're sending it to you. And I say, I'm just going to throw it away. I'm not going to look at it. I'm not even going to look at it for a second. Why would I do that? I just wrote a 400-page novel. Why would I look at, you know, 190-page abridgment? That's just insane. I understand from a business perspective why you must do this, and I have no problem with it. But don't ask me to sit there and read a butchering of my novel.
Dennis Lehane speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. His novel Mystic River has been adapted into a film. Lehane's newest book, Shutter Island, is also a departure from the work he's best known for, the Kenzie and Gennaro Private Eye series. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.